This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. 179,000 black men served with Union forces in the Civil War. And in Florida in 1863, there was a battle that opened the door for their participation. Two black regiments captured Jacksonville, Florida. Our guest this afternoon is historian Stephen Ashe. He says this story is little known but very important. In his new book, Firebrand of Liberty, the story of two black regiments that changed the course of the Civil War, he argues the enlistment of black soldiers helped win the war. He says the successes of the two regiments helped convince Abraham Lincoln to authorize that full-scale enlistment of African Americans. Stephen Ashe also says the story is important because, in his words, it vividly exemplifies the complex web of motives and passions that shaped the events of the war. Listeners, I invite your telephone calls this afternoon for Stephen Ashe. We look forward to your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. Our guest, Stephen Ashe, is professor of history at the University of Tennessee and the author of several books on the Civil War. The most recent, Firebrand of Liberty, the story of two black regiments that changed the course of the Civil War, is published by Norton. Again, the phone numbers 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Professor Ashe, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. This story involves the Union's 1st and 2nd South Carolina regiments. The troops numbered 900. Their commanders were Northern abolitionists. Maybe you would give us here a little bit of an overview of who these men were and how they came to their posts in the regiments.
Early in the Civil War, the United States Army and Navy captured some strategic islands off the coast of South Carolina and Georgia, the idea being to create naval bases where the Union Naval Blockading Squadron could recoal and resupply themselves. In holding these islands, the Union Army also gathered in thousands of black people who had been slaves there and who either escaped from their masters on the mainland or who had been left behind when their masters hurriedly abandoned their plantations when the Union Army and Navy arrived. In 1862, they began recruiting.
Is the guest still there? I think we've lost the guest. We'll try and get him back on the phone here. I don't know what happened. Suddenly he was gone. So Stephen Ashe is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him about his book, Firebrand of Liberty, the story of two black regiments that changed the course of the Civil War. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our technical director this afternoon is Jason Croft, who is giving me the thumbs up now that we have our guest back on the phone. I don't know what happened there.
No, I don't know either. I could hear you fine. At what point did you leave? I'll pick it up there.
We had you telling us about the South Sea Islands or the Sea Islands that were captured, and
right. Yeah, the Union Army and Navy captured these Sea Islands.
And you were talking about 1862 and then 1863.
1862, the Union Army began recruiting some of these slaves who had come into the lines, runaway slaves, recruiting them as soldiers, putting them in uniform and arming them. A few hundred of these were enrolled in the Union ranks by 1860, in the middle of 1862, in a regiment called the 1st South Carolina. These were all runaway slaves. These were all slaves who had left their masters. And eventually a second regiment was also recruited there.
Okay. And making runaway slaves soldiers, was that controversial?
It was very controversial. By January 1st, 1863, Abraham Lincoln had issued his Emancipation Proclamation, which made emancipation of the slaves official Union war policy. But that did not mean that the Union was ready to accept black people in uniform. At this time, in early 1863, there were only a few black regiments. It was still a very controversial kind of experiment. A lot of Northerners were opposed to the idea of putting blacks in uniform side by side with white troops in the Union Army. A lot of Union Army troops themselves were opposed to fighting side by side with blacks. So this was a very controversial matter. The Abraham Lincoln would not go forward with full-scale recruitment of blacks.
Oh, and there we've got another problem again. Professor Ash, are you there? We have another dropout. No, we've got a problem here. Why don't we try and make the connection again? And we'll have a little music to tide us over. We'll try again. Stephen Ash, hi.
Hi.
We're having a tough time here today. But anyway, back to this very interesting story that you were telling us about the making of soldiers from runaway slaves. This was very controversial. And you were talking about, you know, the Emancipation Proclamation, as I recall. And here, let me just kind of backtrack a little bit, and we can talk a little bit about you know, not everyone who opposed the secession of the South favored emancipation. So that, too, was controversial. So maybe you can pick up the story at some point there.
Right, yeah, emancipation had been very controversial from the start of the war. Only most Northerners, when they went to war against the South to oppose secession, did not have in mind turning this into a war to end slavery. A few did, but most were... most Northerners making war against the South simply to restore the Union. As time went by, Abraham Lincoln gradually moved towards a policy of emancipation because it would help win the war, and because he was getting more and more pressure from Northern blacks, Southern blacks, and white abolitionists in the North. So eventually, by January 1st, 1863, he issued the Emancipation Proclamation, which then officially turned the war into a war to end slavery as well as restore the Union. However, that did not mean that blacks would be welcomed into the Union ranks as soldiers to help win that war. That was a whole separate question and a very controversial one.
Yeah. So now let's fast forward to March of 1863, and there are some folks setting sail from South Carolina for Florida. These are the black regiments. What was their mission?
Their mission was an interesting one. It was unlike any other expedition during the Civil War. As originally conceived by its abolitionist officers, these two black regiments would go into Florida to establish a base, and their primary mission was not so much military as it was emancipative. The idea was they would establish a base there and basically try to stir up an enormous slave insurrection that they hoped would spread through the South as a kind of a chain reaction and destroy slavery from within the Confederacy. Mm.
This was the firebrand of liberty.
This is the firebrand of liberty they envisioned, yes. The commander of the expedition, Thomas Wentworth Higginson, a prominent Massachusetts abolitionist and prominent writer before the war, had been a close associate of the famous or infamous John Brown, the fanatical abolitionist who 4 years or several 2 years before the Civil War had tried by seizing a federal armory at Harper's Ferry, had tried to stir up a slave revolt in 1859. That was put down, but Higginson carried on this dream of sparking a slave insurrection in the heart of the South, and hoping it would spread throughout, you know, the region and end slavery. And now, during the Civil War, he felt he had another chance to bring to fruition what John Brown had failed to do a few years earlier.
Yeah. Now, given the furor over John Brown, how was it that this mission came about and went forward?
By 1863, there were people who were, since the war was not going particularly well for the Union at that point, a lot of people in the Union High Command were ready to pull out all the stops to make hard war against the Confederacy, including a group of officers in the South Carolina Sea Islands, all of whom were prominent abolitionists. Higginson's superior, General Hunter, who ultimately gave approval for this expedition, was an abolitionist himself. So by this time, there were people who, although in 1861, people would have been horrified by the idea of sending black Union troops into the heart of the South to spark a slave revolt, by 1863, people were more willing to listen to such an idea.
Yeah. At that point, were people also war-weary?
They were, North and South, they were, but still committed to pursuing the war, or most of them were. But now they were looking for newer ways to, you know, different ways to bring that war to a successful conclusion. So they were willing to try some experiments like this, an expedition that was aimed not so much to defeat the Confederate Army, but to stir up a slave insurrection that would destroy the Confederacy from within.
Mm. You mentioned Thomas Wentworth Higginson, very interesting character. He's one of the key figures in this story. He was a Unitarian minister from Massachusetts, and he eventually came to the conclusion that violence, a revolution, would be needed to end slavery. That says a lot about the depth of his conviction. Would you tell us about his background? How did he get to that point?
He had moved slowly to this position. During his lifetime, he was only about 40 by 1863. He had taken up a lot of progressive causes, including women's rights. He was one of the very few Northern men at that time who believed in full equality for women. He had taken up the cause of workers' rights at a time when the North was industrializing rapidly and there were problems of class conflict. He had taken up a number of other causes, but he was particularly committed to abolitionism. But the abolitionist movement in the pre-Civil War decades was divided. It was divided in a number of ways between those who were complete pacifists, those who rejected the idea of getting involved in politics, those who wanted to get involved in politics, and then a few like John Brown and ultimately Higginson, who believed that only violence was going to end slavery, and that ultimately the slaves themselves must take a hand in destroying slavery. That is, at that point, that is why Higginson was ready to support John Brown and then carry that idea on into the Civil War.
Yeah. He was reluctant, however, to enlist in the Union, in the cause, and join the fight.
He was at first because he thought he might do more good on the home front, agitating to turn. This was before the Emancipation Proclamation, when the idea of when Lincoln had not committed himself to emancipation. Higginson thought he might do more good on the home front, agitating for Lincoln to come out with an Emancipation Proclamation. But eventually, he decided that the army needed to have some more abolitionist influence within it, because the army was a fairly conservative institution. And so Higginson ultimately joined when he was given, and very soon afterwards, he was given this opportunity to go to the Sea Islands and take over a black regiment. Up to that time, he had been commanding been an officer in a white regiment.
Yeah. So he's a captain in the Union, and he's given command of this regiment of freed slaves, the first. How did he feel about that charge?
He was excited about the opportunity, but he was the first to admit that when he arrived in the Sea Islands, he had not known very many black people in his life, and he certainly had not known black people like these who had just emerged from slavery. They were very different. Some of these black men spoke the Gullah language. He could almost not understand a lot of them. He had a difficult time adjusting, as his men had adjusting to him too. But he eventually came to admire these men very, very much. In particular, some of his non-commissioned officers, who he came to rely on greatly.
Yeah. What was the situation on the islands when he and other Union forces arrived?
What they found on those islands was something they had not expected to encounter. Late in 1861, this is before Higginson got there, when the Union Navy and Army first seized these islands, thousands and thousands of slaves had simply been abandoned there by their owners, who were in such a hurry to get away and save themselves and fled to the mainland. So they had on their hands, suddenly the Union Army had, while they had gone to the islands just for military purposes, now they found themselves having to deal with a population of thousands of slaves, nobody whose exact status was uncertain, because they were not really free, but they were certainly no longer slaves. So the Union Army and the Union government in general spent a long time wrangling over what to do about these slaves, and the slaves themselves were demanding to be heard, too, about what they wanted, and ultimately they worked out kind of an arrangement where the slaves, these blacks, went back to work on the plantations there on the Sea Islands, but as free laborers under white people who came down as contract, who rented out these farms from the government.
Mm. And so then they were paid?
They were paid, yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah. Higginson was very curious about the folks that were living there in the Sea Islands and the men who would volunteer to fight with him. What did he learn about their motives for volunteering?
He was very interested in, more so than many officers are interested in their men, he was fascinated by these soldiers. So he would often join them around their campfires and listen to them as they told their stories and sang their songs. And he learned a lot about their motivation. A lot of these men were they had left loved ones on the mainland who were still in slavery. A lot of his men were very committed to the idea of fighting for the Union in order to get back onto the mainland and free their families.
Yeah. Maybe here now you would tell us about a man by the name of Prince Rivers.
Prince Rivers is one of the most interesting characters in the book. He was Higginson's most trusted non-commissioned officer. Sergeant Rivers had been a carriage driver up until 1861, had been a carriage driver for an aristocratic family in Beaufort, South Carolina. He was one of these who hid out when his master hastily abandoned the islands and headed for the mainland when the Union Army and Navy came. He hid out and then reemerged and was making a good living by 1862, making a good living working there in the islands as a free man. But at the very first opportunity, when this regiment, the 1st South Carolina, was recruited, he joined up. He was distinguished from most of the other slaves in that he was literate. Very few of these black men were literate. They had been deliberately kept illiterate by their masters, but he was an exception. He was literate. He was very capable. The other men in the regiment held him in great respect, and Higginson came to rely on him a lot. Higginson, in fact, came to believe that if Prince Rivers had the advantage of formal education, he could have been a general, is what Higginson said.
Mm. One of the interesting things about him to me is that he was looking ahead to the time when the war would be over, and he knew that the fight in a lot of ways would not be over.
Exactly right. He did have a vision of the future. He not only fought like a lot of his fellow soldiers did, to make sure that slavery was destroyed in this war, but he was thinking about the post-war world, and he knew, and he was exactly right in this. He was very prescient. He knew that if the black people came out of this war with nothing but freedom, they were going to face a real struggle after the war. That they must have something more than that. He hoped that they would be able to gain land of their own, so they could secure a basis for real equality after the war, rather than just freedom. This, after the war, this very issue emerged as one of the big ones of the Reconstruction period. And ultimately, the freed slaves were not given land of their own. And as we know, ultimately, their freedom or their equality was not secured.
Hmm. I wonder, did Higginson and Rivers talk about what would come after the war?
That's hard to say. Rivers himself left no documents that we know of about his own thinking. What we know about him has come filtered through records that whites have left, including Higginson's journal. So I can't say that he did, but in general, Higginson was in close touch with his men and knew what was motivating them, and in all probability knew Prince Rivers' thoughts on the subject.
Yeah. What sources did you have to draw on for Firebrand of Liberty? The journal of Higginson is one, and another journal that you had to draw on is of another person who's very interesting in this story, Charlotte Fortin. We'll talk about her in just a minute. But tell us a little bit about the sources that were available to you for this work.
The sources are plentiful, but they tend to be skewed, as I suggested. We don't have a lot of direct testimony from the black soldiers themselves. As I said, they were almost all illiterate. Documentary evidence we do have of their thoughts and their words comes to us through white people who recorded them. But there are a lot of good sources. Higginson's journal, which is voluminous, very useful. Army records. The Union Army was great at record keeping, and there are plenty of records at the National Archives that I used about the internal workings of these two regiments. There were pension records of some of the black soldiers, pension files that were recorded long after the war, which were very, very interesting. And there were lots of newspapers available. One of the great things about for historians doing research about the World Wide Web revolution is that so many of these sources are now coming online. Newspapers, for instance, that in the old days we would have had to travel to a distant archive to look at on microfilm, we can now simply sit down in our office and bring them up on our computer.
Hmm. How did the newspapers of the day cover these the expedition, work of these two black regiments?
Well, it's interesting because the newspapers of the day reflected the divided sentiment of the northern public, and the sentiment of the southern public too, if you include southern newspapers. But if you're thinking of just northern newspapers, the northern public was, as I said, very divided among, on the far left, radical abolitionists who were insisting that blacks be not only freed but recruited in large numbers in the Union Army, and then all the way on the far right had very conservative Democrats, some of whom even opposed making war against the South, much less freeing the slaves, much less putting troops, black troops, into the Union Army. So the newspapers presented a spectrum of opinion, and their coverage of the black troops reflected that too. The abolitionist journals, the journals or newspapers on the left applauded, the work of the black troops. The newspapers on the right criticized it.
Hmm. At the outset of the book, you've included a note on usage, telling readers, among other things, that you have avoided using African-American as it was not used at the time of these events. And you also include some quotations from Prince Rivers. And his speech comes across very differently in each one. As a historian, then, is it a challenge to decipher the intentions, the mindsets of those who recorded the words and deeds of a man like Rivers?
It really is. You have to take into account who's transcribing these words, what they were thinking, who their intended audience was. And it's very interesting. Prince Rivers was quoted a lot by northern newspaper correspondents and other people because he was so much more articulate than most of the slaves, the freed slaves. So he was often sought out by northern journalists and other interested parties to make comments. And reading them, you would never know a lot of times that this was the same person speaking, because some, rendered it into an extreme form of black dialect. Some made him sound like he spoke indistinguishably from whites. I believe that Prince Rivers was actually somewhere in between, but it's very hard for us to know. It is part of the the challenge of being a historian.
Hmm. Historian Stephen Ash is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author most recently of Firebrand of Liberty, the story of two black regiments that changed the course of the Civil War. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, tell us now about Charlotte Forten.
Well, this is one of the nicest surprises I had in doing research for this book, was coming to the understanding that there was such a fascinating cast of characters, and she is one of them. She was a northern black woman, a very light-skinned, young, in her mid-20s, very pretty, very highly educated and cultured black woman from Philadelphia. Her family, for several generations back, had all been free. She had had the advantage of a very good education, played the piano and wrote poetry and wrote newspaper articles. She volunteered to go to the Sea Islands, like a lot of idealistic Northerners, mostly white, did once the Civil War got underway, volunteered to go down to the South to educate these freed slaves. So she ended up as a teacher on one of the Sea Islands, not far from where Higginson's regiment was stationed. And she became involved, actually, in a passionate affair with the surgeon of Higginson's regiment, who was not only white but married and old enough to be her father. So it was a real interesting revelation to me to read her journal, which has been published, and the things she wrote about it, and then read the doctor's published letters. He never mentions anything about it, but in her private journal, she talks about this very intense romantic affair she was having with him.
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener now, a listener in Danville on line four. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. This is such an interesting depiction. My concern is I had a great-grandfather who was killed at the Battle of Richmond, Kentucky in August of 1862, and family story was that he was a captain, and he had been offered a colonelcy for a black regiment that was forming. Now, does that mean that there were black regiments formed before 1862?
No, there were none before 1862. This regiment that became the 1st South Carolina was actually the very first one that was recruited. It was recruited even before there was official authorization for it in April or May of 1862. By the time that official permission was given for the 1st South Carolina to recruit, and it came and it got enough recruits to be actually formed as a regiment, there were a few other black units that were being recruited in occupied areas of the South. There was one by the 1st of January 1863. There was one in Kansas. There were several in Louisiana. And there were some that were starting to be formed in the North. But not very many, and none in Kentucky that I'm aware of.
I see. Well, he was born in New York and served in the Mexican War, but was a school teacher in Kentucky at the time, you know, when he married the daughter of a very southern secessionist. And so I don't know exactly when. I mean, he was with Kentucky Volunteers, and this would have been early, I suppose, in 1862 when this idea of a black regiment was proposed to him. So maybe that was just a family story.
It might be just a family story. It's possible, though, he was offered command of a regiment that was being recruited elsewhere.
See.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. This is most fascinating to listen to.
Well, thank you for your call.
Thanks for the call. Other calls are invited, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We're talking about Charlotte Fortin, a really interesting figure in this story. Were there many women who played a role in this episode of history?
There were more than I expected to find when I first began doing research. There were a number of black women who were attached to the regiment as laundresses or who were married to soldiers in the regiment who were also along on this expedition. So when the expedition finally traveled to Florida, there were not only blacks and whites, but men and women and soldiers and civilians all together.
And did they all together go into Jacksonville?
They did. They did. In March of 1863, when the expedition finally got underway, three transport vessels carried both of these regiments and their white officers and the women who were attached to the regiment as laundresses and cooks, carried all of them up the St. John's River and into Jacksonville.
Hmm. What was daily life like in these regiments?
Daily life up until this time of the expedition had been pretty dull, pretty routine, as only soldiers can know it. Long stretches of boredom with nothing especially going on, and drill every day. They had a routine laid out. You know, they were up at a certain time every day at reveille, and then drills of various sorts during the day, and all the way to taps at night. Their day was pretty well planned out. With the exception of a couple of minor expeditions that some of the companies of the 1st South Carolina had carried out in the fall of 62 and earlier in 1863, the regiment had not seen a lot of fighting. It was not heavily engaged with Confederates. In fact, there was not much going on in that whole theater of war. It was a quiet theater of war until Higginson got this expedition going.
So when the expedition was launched, were they prepared to fight?
They were, because Higginson had drilled them well. They had had experience in some of the companies had had experience in a few skirmishes. Higginson still, you know, was concerned that they, since they were not seasoned combat veterans, he was still concerned about how they would behave in combat. As he was concerned about himself too, because he had no combat experience. But ultimately, the tough training that discipline he had instilled in that regiment paid off, because in Florida they behaved superbly.
Okay, so March 10th, 1863, how do things begin?
The troops left the Sea Islands a few days earlier, steamed up the St. John's River on March the 10th, and were unsure what they would find when they got to Jacksonville. It was quite a tense moment as they steamed up just after dawn on March the 10th to Jacksonville, because this was now deep in Confederate territory. This was the idea that they would get deep into Confederate territory and establish this post, and then from there start operating up and down the river and into the interior, freeing slaves and trying to stir things up. But they had no idea what they would encounter in Jacksonville. It could have been Confederate troops there laying in wait, you know, lying in ambush. That they had heard rumors that the Confederates had threatened to burn down the town if the Union tried to capture it. They did not know what to expect. As it turned out, the capture of the town turned out to be easy and quick. The Confederates were not occupying the town. But afterwards, once they had established themselves in the town and started to fortify it, then the problems began, because the Confederate troops in the neighborhood then rallied and tried to drive them out of Jacksonville.
Yeah. And eventually, not long afterwards, they were ordered to withdraw.
It was quite an abrupt and mysterious, puzzling, and ultimately very disappointing outcome. After 3 weeks, in which they were actually accomplishing great things, they were freeing slaves, they were moving up and down the river and into the interior, seizing provisions, they were striking fear in the hearts of the Confederate, the white people who lived in the region, but all the time never, you know, they were under good discipline and they were never abusing any civilians. Suddenly, mysteriously, this same General Hunter, who had approved the expedition earlier, suddenly just pulled the plug on it. He sent an order that the expedition should pack up and leave Florida and come back to its base in the South Carolina Sea Islands.
Mm. How did that sit with Higginson?
Higginson and all his troops were deeply disappointed because they had been accomplishing great things, and they were convinced that had they been given more time in Florida, they could have very well at least gotten a good start on their primary objective of really stirring up a slave insurrection in the area. So it was a great disappointment to them. Mm. Ultimately, however, Higginson and some of the others came to understand that the expedition had not been fruitless, even though it seemed to end so disappointingly. Ultimately, it had a far greater impact than they had supposed it might.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. Well, that's probably where we'll wrap things up here in a couple of minutes. But let's take another call. In the meantime, a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi, you're on the air with historian Stephen Ash.
Hi.
Hi.
I missed the first part of your program, but I was one of those that also had a great-great-grandfather that served as a lieutenant for a regiment of volunteers of African descent in Louisiana. And he was a volunteer from Iowa, and I did a research paper on him when I was in college when I needed a history paper that had original sources. And we have diaries that follow his progress through the Civil War. And I think my main question is, who all would be interested in the diaries or materials that we have? They're currently in the possession of an elderly uncle, and I would certainly be interested in them after he's gone because I have this interest in history. But he talks about his experiences very similarly to what you're discussing, and I just don't want this to be lost to history.
I think you're exactly right to be thinking like that, because so often these important materials like this are lost if they're not properly preserved. So I would strongly urge you to donate those to a research library. There are many that would be interested in having fascinating historical materials like that. Donate them to a special collections library who will preserve them and make them available to scholars.
Any that you would suggest that are specializing in this particular aspect of the Civil War?
You say he served in Louisiana with a black unit in Louisiana?
Yeah, he was a volunteer from Iowa, but as he went down the Mississippi, he was involved in protection of the Mississippi. He was involved in Vicksburg and Milliken's Bend and Yazoo Pass and some of those areas. And I think it was that early part of 1863, after they approved use of the volunteers of African descent, that he received his commission in charge of, I think it was the 11th Louisiana Regiment. And so I've got lots of documentation.
Yeah, there are a number of archives who would be particularly interested in that. I'm thinking of the Historic New Orleans Collection, the Tulane University Archives, the Mississippi State Archives in Jackson, or the what's called the Southern Historical Collection at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, which has a huge... an important collection of manuscripts of all sorts on Southern history. All of those would be glad to have such a thing. Also, the U.S. Army's Military History Institute in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, has a big collection. It's always interested in important materials like that that bear on the experience of the U.S. Army in the Civil War.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Stephen Ash. He's a historian. He's the author most recently of Firebrand of Liberty, the story of two black regiments that changed the course of the Civil War. And now we get to the outcome of the expedition, the invasion of Jacksonville, Florida, in March of 1863. And it was not fruitless, even though the regiments were ordered to withdraw. That's because the successes of these two regiments helped convince Abraham Lincoln to authorize the full-scale enlistment of African Americans. Talk with us about that.
Well, this was one of the surprise findings of my research. One of the reasons no historian ever done much about this expedition was it seemed that it didn't amount to much. But what I discovered in the course of my research was this was finally the key to Lincoln's decision. Many historians who have discussed the use of black troops in the Civil War point to this moment in late March of 1863 when Lincoln suddenly and quite abruptly changed his mind and decided to go forward with full-scale recruitment of blacks, as I said, which was still a very controversial topic. But none has ever connected to the Florida expedition. What I have shown is that it was the reports of the Florida expedition that got into the northern newspapers, including one particular one, in which an editor, a Washington, D.C. newspaper editor, who had previously been opposed to the use of black troops, tells his readers, "I've just read the latest reports from Florida. The troops are doing great. We've got to change our policy." And I'm persuaded that Lincoln saw that, or Lincoln and his top advisors saw that, and that was that, along with the other reports they had been getting directly about the success of the black troops in Florida, finally turned them to make the momentous decision to go forward with full-scale recruitment of blacks, and that had a very great impact on the Union victory in the Civil War.
Hmm.
So it could have turned out very differently. Had those black troops in Florida collapsed in the face of the Confederate counterattacks, had they abused the civilian population, or had they gotten into a race riot with the white troops? There were ultimately some white Union troops that were sent as reinforcements alongside whom they fought. Had that turned into a racial conflict, anything could have gone wrong. And had it done so, Lincoln might very well have derailed the whole movement to recruit black troops and never allowed any more to be recruited, in which case the exploits of other black units later in the war, including the famous 54th Massachusetts that was portrayed in the movie Glory, that never would have happened. That unit never would have been given that opportunity to make that historic attack there on, against Fort Wagner later in 1863, had not the 1st and 2nd South Carolina paved the way with this successful Florida expedition.
Mm. What was your introduction to this story, to this episode of history?
Well, I've been studying the Civil War all my life, and I was looking for a fresh topic some years ago after I finished a previous book. And it seemed to me I kind of gradually narrowed the topic, but I got interested in the war on the Sea Islands because that theater of war had never been discussed much by historians. So I started looking generally into what was going on in the Sea Islands and stumbled across this expedition, which even a lot of people who are very knowledgeable about the Civil War, scholars and buffs alike, have never even heard of. And I thought, well, what an intriguing story. But only as I got into it did I discover just how intriguing it was.
Hmm. So it's a lifelong interest and a little serendipity.
Exactly right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we have to wrap up pretty quickly now. I'm curious about, and I'm thinking our listeners would like to know as well, following the war, what became of Prince Rivers? What became of the black veterans of the 1st and 2nd?
Well, in an epilogue in the book, I discuss what I know about some of them, and their stories are interesting and in some cases kind of sad. Prince Rivers himself turned out to be just as talented as Higginson had predicted. Prince Rivers himself, after the war, during the Reconstruction period, when blacks were given voting rights in South Carolina, eventually rose to become a state, you know, militia commander and a state representative. However, after the conservative reaction overthrew Reconstruction in the South, he wound up again as a carriage driver, just like he had been as a slave, a sad and ironic ending for him. Many of the other soldiers were, almost all of them stayed in the South, near where they grew up. They followed different paths.
What a fascinating story. There, we'll wrap it up. I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Stephen Ashe is the author of Firebrand of Liberty, the story of two black regiments that changed the course of the Civil War. Our guest, Stephen Ashe, is a professor of history at the University of Tennessee. The book Firebrand of Liberty is published by W.W. Norton.